I'm Vivian Howard, and I'm a chef in Eastern North Carolina. Much of my work and my message is about connecting people to their food source. I want consumers to understand that a real live person grows their food, a person with feelings and a family and tremendous resourcefulness, intelligence. I want us to understand that farmers are human beings that grow the food we eat. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. It's nice to hear your voice.
Nice to hear your voice. You have a nice voice.
Well, thank you. I'm a professional speaker, so I'm supposed to, but it's highly trained, let's put it that way.
So, yeah, I've been reading up on you, and what I found is that you're a professional speaker, but what did you do before that?
I actually have worked my entire career in agriculture. I'm a farm girl from Michigan originally. I've always had black and white cattle, known as Holsteins, in my life, so I have a little bit of a love affair with them, but I worked, when I first graduated from college, I worked in international dairy genetics and then moved on to developing sponsorships for National FFA Foundation and agriculture education. And then I've been professionally speaking and writing for 16 years now.
Oh, wow. That's not what we're supposed to talk about, but I find that very, very interesting. I do a little bit of public speaking myself, and I have a lot of anxiety beforehand. So I admire that you can make that your life.
Well, you know, that it's normal. Because seriously, all my professional speaking colleagues, if you don't have adrenaline or nerves beforehand, you suck.
Right. Right.
So it's just a matter of, you know, kind of corralling them. And I know it's different for different people, but, yeah, the more you speak, the easier it gets.
So, you know, I was looking at your book, and I think it's so relevant to consumers today, because as I read, you know, everybody eats. We need food for fuel and nutrition and sustenance, but very few people have a connection to their food source. And most people have never even been on a real farm. And so I think that fact creates a lot of confusion when we go to the grocery store. And your book really touches on all of that. And so I'd like to know, I kept seeing this term half-truths in your materials, and I'd like for you to tell me what you think some of these half-truths are.
Sure. Well, I wrote Food Tours from Farm to Table to really try to help people feel good when they go to the grocery store. I mean, right, you love food, and you know how important it is to have it as part of a family. And so when I think about half-truths, things like gluten-free cat litter come to mind. GMO-free water, GMO-free vegetables, antibiotic-free milk, antibiotic-free meat. And the reason why they're half-truths is because they're marketing labels. So, for example, gluten-free, you know, there's very few grains that actually have gluten in them. And so some of those claims and the whole movement around gluten is a little concerning. But the GMO-free is very concerning because obviously people are very up in arms about technology and their food, and they want the good, happy story of yesteryear. But the reality is there's only, I think, 6 or 8 foods that are actual GMO. And so in my example, peppers are not one of them. There's no GMO peppers. So the fact that it says GMO-free is misleading. Because there's no such thing. And going on down the line, antibiotics are not allowed in any USDA milk. There's very stringent levels that are set. And so it's just all of this that makes people who are buying food stop and question whether they're doing the right thing.
Right, because if you've got antibiotic-free milk, it leads you to believe that there's milk that's riddled with antibiotics.
Yeah, exactly. And the story, and you're absolutely right, Vivian, because 75% of people haven't been on a farm or ranch in the last 5 years, according to a study that came out of my alma mater, Michigan State. And Michigan's an incredibly diverse agricultural state. And if 75% of those people haven't been on a farm or ranch, How are they going to know that milk is typically tested at least 6 points between the cow and the cup to be sure it does not have any antibiotics in it? And so that antibiotic-free claim, that's one that really upsets me, frankly, because of course milk's antibiotic-free. You know, no dairy farmer wants to pump their cow full of antibiotics. You treat cattle for animal welfare and health reasons. You don't do it for profitability.
So what about hormone-free?
So that's a great question, Vivian. So my question to you is, do you have hormones?
I sure do.
Yeah, we have a lot of them, right? And they stink. Absolutely. So here's the deal. All your food has hormones in it. If you use maple syrup in your recipes, you're basically pouring tree hormone sap. Because the only food that's on your plate that would not have a hormone in it is salt.
Wow. Okay.
So people have been led to believe that hormones are bad. And one of the things that I addressed, it's actually food truth number one, is that hormones are in everything. Because hormones basically are the chemical messengers of life. And you need them to live. A tree needs them to live. A tomato plant needs them to live. Cattle need them to live. Hormones are not the bad guys that they've been made out to be. I think it's because of steroid use, maybe in some of, you know, the bodybuilders, that people just assume that hormones are bad. I've never gotten to the bottom of it. But the reality is that hormones are in all of our food.
Right. Well, you know, I heard this rumor years ago that, you know, all the hormones in our milk and in our chicken and, you know, chickens are so big because they've been pumped full of hormones. And then now my daughter's going to go through puberty when she's 4 years old because of the chicken that I fed her. You know, that's a scary rumor when you hear that.
Well, of course it is. And I have a daughter. I get it. I mean, and as a female, of course, I get how horrific hormones are, because none of us really enjoy the hormonal surges. But in part one of the book is dairy. I started with that because that's closest to my heart. And because hormones and antibiotics and many things around animal welfare seem to swirl as rumors, as you said. And I actually offered several studies that showed that hormones are not causing early onset puberty. In other words, girls getting boobs at an earlier age. What's causing it likely is the caloric increase. Mm-hmm. So in other words, we're eating more food and girls are developing earlier, because puberty, without getting into grossing anyone out, puberty is essentially the body's preparation for pregnancy, to reproduce, right?
Right.
So if you eat enough food and your body's at the point where it has a high enough body fat level, it says, oh, well, okay.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And so it sounds like an oversimplification, but I've actually studied the issue quite a lot because I was aware of the concerns. I have a daughter myself, and it's pretty clear that hormones are not causing our kids to develop earlier. A lot of it is because of our nutrition. When you consider 50 years ago, what nutrition was like for children versus today, it's very different. I mean, we micromanage everything for our kids, right? As far as food.
I try.
Yeah, we all do, right? That's our role as moms, to be the food Nazis. But
So for dairy, what do you buy at the grocery store?
Yeah, I buy store brand 2%. And I buy store brand cottage cheese. And I will tell you, studies show that full fat dairy actually is good for you. I choose to buy lower fat. I don't buy non-fat, but I do buy lower fat. So I get store brand lower fat cottage cheese, store brand lower fat sour cream. And one of the things that I really try to emphasize in the book, particularly in the conclusion, is that you have to make choices for your family on your own ethical, social, nutrition, and environmental standards. And my standards are such that I know the processing, and I know that store brand, in many cases, not all, but that store brands are processed at exactly the same place as the major brands.
So, Michelle, you mentioned environmental standards. What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the things that is largely misunderstood about our food being produced are chemicals. And one of the things I love to shock people with is that food truth number 9, chemicals are naturally in food and needed to protect it, closely followed by food truth number 5, organic farming is about production methods, not nutritional value. Chemicals are needed to keep bugs, weeds, and various other things out of plants. So whether you're growing blueberries in Michigan or citrus in Florida or wheat in Idaho, bugs like to attack plants. If you've ever grown tomatoes in your garden or backyard, you know that aphids come and attack. Chemicals are actually produced by plants naturally. Chemicals are not necessarily things. You as a human being are made up of chemicals. That's one of those scientific things that's largely misunderstood. And organic farmers use chemicals. They are different chemicals, but chemicals are used in organic. So I think that's one of the misnomers. And in a nutshell, the way that I would summarize my position on environmental standards is that sustainability is complex and essential to family businesses, which is actually food truth number 12. And what I mean by that is that sustainability isn't just being organic. Sustainability isn't just not spraying chemicals, because in fact, both of those things decreases production. So my environmental standards are to purchase products that are produced in the most efficient, environmentally friendly way. And that's not always the answer that most people that assume that it is, because sustainability has to be about long-term views. And long-term views are successful family businesses. And farms can't make it if they can't produce food efficiently. And part of that is the ability to use successfully proven, highly researched chemicals and making sure that they can get the most food out of the land as possible, again, in an environmentally friendly way, in a way that they can make money. So, fast answer.
So, I do not buy full-fat organic milk. And I can't really explain why I buy the organic, except that I have the means to do it. And I feel as if I can, I should. Am I wasting my money?
The difference in organic milk, well, let me ask you, what do you think the difference is between organic and just regular milk?
The cows eat organic grain and grass, and it makes me feel better about myself when I buy it.
And that's the food. That's why I wrote Food Truths, is because people need permission to feel good about regular, normal food. And Vivian, I understand you have the means to do it, and I'm certainly not criticizing you as a mom. You get to make the food choices that you want to make. And you actually were correct in everything that you said. Most people say they buy organic milk because they want it to be organic, or excuse me, antibiotic free. All milk's antibiotic free at the same levels because of the FDA, USDA protocols that there are out there. And you are correct that cattle are fed organic grain and organic grasses. But does that make a more superior product? Not necessarily.
No.
But if it's the choice that you want to make for your family, great. The only thing that I would ask is when you're out there talking about food, to consider the moms that don't have the means or the dads that can't buy organic, and to help them feel okay and know they're doing the right thing for their family.
Yeah, no, I never I never preach organic. And honestly, the only organic thing that I buy in the grocery store is milk, because it's so clearly labeled and it's such an easy, you know, it's right there with all the other milk. And
yes, of course it is.
But, you know, now, I mean, I have the means, but I'm not rolling around in a pile of money. So I'm just better informed after this conversation, and I'm going to buy the store brand.
Yeah. And I would suspect, now I will tell you that different people can tell the taste in different brands of milk. So if you don't like one brand, switch to another. And I actually share in the book how you can tell in both the meat and the egg case, how you can tell where the product was processed at. So that if for some reason you want to compare, say, Prairie Farms, which is where the milk from my cows goes to, versus the Kroger brand, you can see where they were processed.
Well, that is what is going to determine the taste.
That's what some people think, is that different brands taste different. And there is a discernible difference in some of them. And I have to be very careful, because I grew up on a dairy farm where we drank milk from our cows, but it was pasteurized and it was skimmed. And so milk from the store doesn't taste the same to me as it does to normal people, just because that's my reference point, is, you know, our dairy farm.
Right. Well, what about eggs? I think there's a lot of confusion around eggs and cage-free and free-range, and what should I be looking for when I'm shopping for eggs?
Well, the egg case, I actually went through all of the different claims, because I interviewed farmers throughout the book and tried to make sure I had their perspective on it. And eggs is very complicated, because the reality is, I mean, if we were to be very grotesque, people think that chickens are abused, and that, you know, an egg is only a good thing if the chicken was out running around free range and hugging each other. You know, I'm being a little sarcastic, and I don't mean to insult anyone, but I think because of, you have to look at the science when it comes to animal care. One of my degrees is in animal science, and while I try not to talk about science too much and prefer to share the deep, rich stories that we have from the farm, the egg section, which is part two of the book, covers in great detail what it means to be free range, what it means to be in a cage, what the different claims mean. So, for example, one of the things that people like to buy are the omega eggs. And you would have to eat, I forget the number, but it's a substantial number of eggs in order to benefit from a chicken that was fed omegas. So in other words, there's not a lot of sense of doing it. And when it comes to animal welfare, it was fascinating when I wrote the book for me to see the numbers and the data. But a quick summary of what it shows as far as cage-free versus free-range versus in cages, this is the way that I summarize it for people. Chickens are quite frankly, nasty little scavengers. They will eat anything that their little beaks get into. They also are carnivorous, which means they will eat each other if given the opportunity. And so I don't mean to be grossing anyone out, but there's a reason why chickens are in cages. When I go to the grocery store, I buy generic eggs with as few claims as there can be on the box, because an egg is an egg is an egg. And to me, a chicken being in a cage in a highly managed environment where their temperature is controlled, their diseases are controlled, because you can get salmonella from eggs, you can get various diseases from backyard chickens. I want to be sure that my food is safe. And eggs are a great protein source, don't get me wrong. But it's just a matter of knowing the animal's habits to understand why they're managed the way they are. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. I've had chickens in my backyard, and you're right, they are nasty little scavengers. And I have to agree that I want an egg that's been in a controlled environment, because it seems as if eggs could be dangerous based on what I've seen.
Well, yeah, and I think what is really cool about today's farming practices, people worry about the size of farms, but the reality is 96% of farms in this country are still family owned. But when you look, for example, at the egg business, there's a lot of large farms. And the reason why that is the case is because of economics. And with all of these increased regulations that we're seeing and people's concerns and legislative movements around hen housing, you know, for eggs, it's really tough, quite frankly, to try to be able to support a family in the egg business and a lot of different farming occupations. So the larger farms have more regulations, and they honestly usually have more data and science around why they do what they do. For example, they wash their eggs. I mean, everybody who produces eggs commercially has their eggs washed. But the way that those hens are in a controlled environment, honestly, is to the hen's best advantage, because they're not out there pecking each other.
Right. But, you know, a lot of people are really concerned about animal welfare and how, you know, the state of the bird's life. What do you think, you know, how does that play into this? Like, how can we have animals that are treated with dignity, I guess, even though they're going to be eaten? And does that even matter?
Yeah, that is a really interesting question. And it's one that I've spent a lot of time talking with other moms when I was researching for the book about. I know people are deeply concerned. And I can tell you this as a person who has owned animals my entire life, it is an absolute honor and privilege to care for them. I know that their purpose, just as my daughter who owns cattle too, we both know that their purpose is to provide food for people and that they will eventually die to do that. And most farmers and ranchers feel very strongly that it is a distinct privilege to care for animals. We do try to treat animals with respect, regardless of how their life is going to end, but they're not pets.
No, they're not. And often I think there's this misconception that animals frolicking around in a field, birds foraging for, or chickens foraging for worms, that somehow that is a more humane existence than animals living in a building. But, you know, it gets cold at certain times of year, or it gets really hot certain times of year. And perhaps the pig running in the forest does not have as much of a balanced, nutritious diet as one that is being fed a consistent, nutrition-filled diet. So there's this, I think there's a misconception about how that is handled as well.
There absolutely is. I would love to hear how you think we could get over that, because those of us that are working with animals, I mean, for example, I have coyotes running my creek bed. And one of the reasons why I have the dogs is to make sure that my calves stay safe. And, you know, I don't have a lot of concerns about wildlife here in Indiana, but people that are out west have some significant concerns. And Wanda, the farmer that I interviewed up in Minnesota, who's actually a pig farmer, so she's a bacon maker, she talked about how they used to have their hogs outside. And she lives in extreme conditions. So, you know, the hog, they'd go out there and the pigs would be frozen. They couldn't get into their feed trough because it was frozen. Or, you know, when the pigs do not like heat. So when it's 90 degrees and 90% humidity, that's very stressful. And then you have predators and then you have diseases. And like with hogs, there's trichinosis to be concerned about if they're outside. So the challenge that we have is, you know, barns have developed into these metal buildings and people think we're trying to hide things, when in fact, it's usually about biosecurity and animal comfort. Because you can't control the temperature on a 90-degree day in Minnesota without a barn locked up and all the fans and air conditioners on.
And, you know, in a lot of these hog houses, when it's hot out and maybe perhaps year-round, they have water dripping on them all day. Because yeah, they don't have sweat glands. They can't sweat. And that's how they cool off. And that's why we have this idea of pigs rolling around in a mud puddle.
Personally, I'd rather my pig to be in a temperature-controlled barn, knowing that they're being raised without that stress. You know, and the same for cattle, too, because, for example, dairy cattle have sprinklers when it gets real hot because they don't like being hot either. You know, they're out there producing milk. So there's a lot of technologies and old school and new school combination of what's happening in barns that's really neat. You know, whether you look at robots or you look at some of the infrared things or the temperature control things, it's amazing. What happens in a barn, but people are scared because they don't know. And that's why I encourage throughout Food Truths from Farm to Table, please get on a farm, talk to a farmer on social media. There's a lot of us that are out there. And if you need someone, contact me. And I will be glad to try to hook you up with a farmer or rancher in the state that you're in.
So Michelle, I want to ask a question about GMOs.
Yes.
But I can't even really ask the question because I don't know enough. I don't think I'm informed in the right way to ask. But I think there's so much guilt around GMOs and everyone's looking at labels, hoping that this is a GMO-free whatever. And first of all, I'd like to know why we have this fear of GMOs, what a GMO is, and are there dangerous ones?
Well, that is a very loaded question.
Sorry.
No, I'll do my best. But first, I would love to hear from you. What do you think's wrong with GMOs? And I'm not going to criticize you in any way. So please, I'm just very curious in the interest of conversation. What's your impression of GMOs?
Well, I think that GMOs are, well, I think, first of all, I think much of the food that we eat is modified in some way, whether it's selection and selection of breeding. Mm-hmm. I also know that most of the food that we eat has no opportunity to be a GMO. Mm-hmm. You know, like you said, there's no GMO peppers. There's no GMO tomatoes available in the United States. Mm-hmm. So what I think about GMOs is that there's just a lot of misinformation out there.
Yes.
And I get asked questions all the time in a public format about GMOs. And I have a certain opinion that I'd like to share, but I'm afraid that I'm going to get chastised.
So I truly believe this food truth, and it is the hardest one that I had to write. It's food truth number 10. Genes are the coolest ingredient on your plate. So real quickly, you had referenced earlier people being concerned about chickens being pumped with hormones. Chickens are not GMO. Let me just be very clear about that. However, chicken breasts are big because of genes, because of breeding. That's the way chickens have been bred, because that's what consumers like. We like to cook chicken breasts in the United States. So chickens have been bred using genetic selection, which is a normal breeding technique when you're breeding cattle. They've been bred to have larger breasts. It's illegal to give chickens hormones. So then you bring that over to the plant side. And I don't know about you, but do you like seedless watermelons?
I do.
Yeah. And, you know, Kevin Folta, who I think you know, does a great job of explaining the technology behind that. It's actually not GMO. Seedless grapes are not GMO either. Some people try to make that claim. But they're great convenience food, right? There's clear consumer benefits to that. So GMOs are difficult to talk about because it's so emotional. So what I always try to do, and what I did throughout the book, were because I discussed genetics in nearly every section and shared several stories about how cool genes are. And my favorite one is actually how the papaya in Hawaii, where our papaya is produced in the States, was saved by a cucumber gene. It's a great story, and I interviewed one of the farmers out there that I happen to know their family personally, and it is true that the papaya trees would have been destroyed if it were not for a cucumber gene because of ring spot virus. So it's a really cool story in the produce section. But this is the way that I like to start the GMO discussion. Diabetics today who are childhood onset diabetes are treated with GMO insulin. So if GMOs are so bad, those diabetics probably either wouldn't have the quality of life or wouldn't be alive. And I will openly admit I completely lucked into this one, but when I was interviewing a canola farmer, and canola is a GMO crop, when I was interviewing a canola farmer up in Canada, he shared the story of his daughter was diagnosed with diabetes at 7 years old. And he was crystal clear that the quality of her life would be significantly different if it were not for GMOs because of the consistency of the product. Because some people, when they were produced, when insulin was produced by pigs and animals, they had sensitivity and allergies to the animals. But now, because they are produced by the combination of using what was pulled out of the pig and a bacterium, it's very consistent quality GMO without the allergies to animals, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So fascinating story on GMOs, one that many people aren't familiar with. So in a nutshell, this is how I describe GMOs. Take a look at your phone. Don't look at your text or anything. Take a look at your phone. And, you know, if you took Instagram off your phone, I'm assuming you have an iPhone.
I do.
Okay. So if you take Instagram off your iPhone, is it still an iPhone?
Yes.
Okay. And you put Twitter on in place of Instagram, is it still an iPhone?
Yes.
Okay. So with a corn plant, if you take a gene that makes that corn plant naturally resistant to rootworm and put it on there as an app, is it still a corn plant?
Yes.
That's what GMO is. And the people think that it's, you know, companies are out there injecting plants and there's these horrific things that are happening. And here's what I know factually, because I've seen the plants firsthand, I've seen the research, and I've seen the dollars. It takes millions of dollars to bring a biotechnology product to market. GMO has the opportunity to help cure blindness in countries that don't have enough food, but they're not allowed to because of politics around GMOs. GMOs have the opportunity to reduce significant pesticide application because GMO corn truly is resistant to rootworm. And what I described is dead on accurate, because you take a gene from a bacterium, you stick it in the corn plant becomes resistant to rootworm, and you no longer have to spray that cornfield for rootworm. And then there's nutrition benefits. You look at soybean oils and you look at some of the cool things that's been done around soybean oil and biotechnology. And then you look at CRISPR technology and apples. I mean, I, for one, really think brown apples are disgusting. So Arctic apples basically just turned off the gene that allows the apple to turn brown when it's getting oxygen. But it's not allowed to be used in McDonald's because of the consumer backlash. So I understand you don't trust what you don't know, but one of the greatest challenges, and I'm sure you see this in your work too, Vivian, one of the greatest challenges I faced when I was writing this book was trying to get people's scientific understanding to the point where you can explain this. Because if you don't understand that your food has DNA in it, and one study by Jason Lusk out of Oklahoma State showed that 75% of Americans think that their food needs to be labeled if it has DNA in it. All of our food.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's what we're dealing with. And so how do you understand GMO if you don't understand that your Cheetos have DNA in them?
Right, right. I mean, our understanding of the food that we're putting in our body is so basic and non-existent, really, that we're not prepared to understand these issues of GMO and animal welfare and gluten. And so we have a lot of education that needs to happen. I think everybody needs to read your book is what it sounds like.
Well, I appreciate that. And that was the motivation behind the book, is because I understand that everyone wants a great story around their food. I mean, clearly you love to cook. You're clearly talented at it. You know, one of the things that I have hanging in my dining room over my table is that the greatest memories are created around the table. And I truly believe that. I mean, the stories and the memories that happen around food and meals are so important. So I understand, to all of your listeners, I understand you want a great story about food. But I'm telling you, the best untold story about food in North America are the people who produce it. And there is no question in my mind, after being on thousands of farms all across our country, that they're doing it the right way for the right reasons. But there's, you know, 1.5% of our population are on a farm or ranch, and they're modest people who work really hard and don't have a lot of time and don't have a lot of money. And it's really hard for them to deal with all of these questions because they're just out there trying to grow food.
Right.
So I would really encourage people to try to get to the truth. And, you know, I'm not suggesting you all have to buy GMO food. I'm not suggesting you all have to buy organic. I'm simply saying no. The complete story before you make your choices.
The story of the people growing our food is incredibly interesting, and they're human beings, and they don't have a public persona necessarily, or a positive one anyway. So I feel like if there's some way we could get people in front of farmers, then I think there would be less fear around our food, because you could see that farmers are people and they're growing food that they would feed their families. And in that way, it makes it personal and makes them someone we can relate to.
Absolutely. And they're all parents. And usually we have multiple generations. You know, my daughter goes out and feeds her cattle before school every day. You know, we're not out there as some huge big business. We're out there trying to produce food the right way, and we're doing it with family beside us. So it's really a great thing to be able to produce food. People don't farm because it's so easy to do. They farm because they love it and they're wonderful people. So my hope is that Food Tourists from Farm to Table gives you an inside look at that, gives you some ideas and hopefully answers some of the questions like you've had, Vivian.
What do you stay away from when you go to the grocery store?
I adamantly refuse to buy the packages that have the most marketing on them.
Oh, really?
Because they're often lies. Mm-hmm. And I am, I will openly admit, I'm probably not very pleasant to go to the grocery store with, because when I go to the grocery store, and it took a writing coach for me to understand this, believe it or not, not writing, to be clear. She said, Michelle, you have a completely different perception when you go to the grocery store because you think about the people. No one else has that reference point, or very few other people have the reference point, because I think about the people that I know that produce the food. But what makes me really mad are all the claims, because, you know, I can't just look at a bag of tortilla chips and think about my friends in Iowa that grow white corn. I have to sit there and look at all the non-GMO, non-this, non-that, and it infuriates me. In all honesty, I do try to stay away from foods that are highly processed, but I also buy convenience food. You know, there's nothing wrong with buying canned vegetables and frozen fruit.
Michelle, I wish that we could talk for hours, because I have a lot of questions. I think we need to have a podcast on each of these topics and just talk about. I would love to talk about GMOs for an hour and talk about organic for an hour and talk about chemical or environmental standards. I know I'm somewhat irrational, but I think we're barely touching the tip of the iceberg with these topics. So
absolutely.
Since we're probably not going to be able to do that, how can people find you and learn more about your message?
Well, you can find Food Tourists from Farm to Table. It's actually a number one bestseller on Amazon, so you can catch it there. I actually am having a Thanksgiving special on my website, Cause Matters, CauseMatters.com, which is where you can find more about my speaking programs. I love to talk to foodie groups, dietetic groups, and anybody with a food, nutrition, or, of course, an agriculture interest. And my social handle is @mpayne, so M-P-A-Y-N, speaker. You can find me on nearly all the social channels, and I'd be delighted to connect with any of you and invite you to read Food Tourists from Farm to Table and give me some feedback. And Vivian, hopefully we can continue the conversation.
I hope so. And I'm going to go follow you on Instagram right now.
Sounds awesome. I'll follow you back.